Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by outsourcing around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. So when you buy from American Giant, you're taking a stand for hardworking people, local communities, and quality clothes. American Giant directly supports American manufacturers and ensures you aren't footing that tariff bill. Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
It's the Fri-Yay Cocktail, presented by Anna Glavinsky.
My next guest is going to be talking about, well, launching a brand new track, actually, which is very, very exciting, but also talking about music that he has produced from the past. Absolutely rich history, and also one that sort of gets involved in debates and arguments. So if you've been interested in music and music production, maybe since the 80s, then take a listen to this, because the landscape of music has changed radically. Technology has played a huge role in that as well. So it's going to be a sort of a bit of a historical chat, I think, having a look and a delve into the past, but also bringing it right up to date and making sure that everyone's opinions are involved. Hi, Steve, how are you doing?
Hi, good, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for joining us this afternoon. Where are you calling in from?
I'm actually currently staying at my daughter's, which is in Essex. She's just moved, hence you can see some of the boxes. So I found a quiet corner.
Oh, well, that's really nice of you, doing the dad duties. Because I live in Spain and my parents have literally flown out just before I came into the studio myself to give me a hand with some stuff as well. So, yeah.
Excellent. Because as you know, we're normally based in Liverpool. And Maeve herself is actually travelling back to her parents in Wales.
Yeah, so Maeve is, if you can just give us in your own words, a bit of an introduction.
So I've been obviously recording for many, many years, and it's an interesting story how we met. I worked with a guy at Warner Brothers Records, and by complete coincidence, we both moved to Los Angeles at the same time. This was the early 90s. And many, many years later, it was just before lockdown, he said to me, I've discovered this young woman who I think you'd really get on well with. Can I bring her up to Liverpool, meet with you? And we met, and Maeve has a presence. You know, she walks through the door and you go, that's a star. We were just about to think of ideas, and then COVID happened and lockdown. But for us, we used that time to develop Zoom and develop a way of working where we could collaborate sort of in the Zoom world. And then the moment lockdown was finished, she came and we worked physically on the records. And we've been working for a while now, but our most recent records have been doing so well. It's really, and it's interesting talking to you in Spain. Literally a couple of days ago, I have a friend who's based in Ibiza who manages a large number of the DJs, and our previous record, Gatekeeper, he sent me an email. He said, Steve, is that your record? I went, yeah. So I went to a barbecue and the DJs were playing it. He said, I love it. He said, so much so that the DJs that I manage, and these are quite big names in Ibiza, are all going to play it when the season starts, I guess, in a few days' time.
That's really exciting. Super cool.
Yeah, it is, because I've never had that.
How often do people just come up and say, like, oh, I've discovered someone, definitely a talent, and you're just like, oh, yeah, here goes.
It's rare. It is very, very rare. You're absolutely right. And I mean, going back, of course, to, you know, Culture Club, who I'm best known for, George absolutely has that. And anybody that's met George will testify to that.
Which other bands historically have you worked with? Because you've worked with some big names as a producer.
Well, it depends on sort of which era. But obviously, Culture Club is my main one. Then after Culture Club, I produced Ziggy Marley. I went to Jamaica to record that. Then I worked on the Beach Boys 1985 album, which this is the anniversary, believe it or not, of the Beach Boys album. And then through the sort of early 90s, I started doing film and television work, which is why I went to California, because obviously you have to kind of base yourself there for a while. That's sort of where it works. Although, strangely, the projects I started were American productions based in England, but then they moved to California to continue the work. And then when I moved back to England, which was the mid-90s, I started working with a lot of the sort of boy and girl groups of the time. And I guess the most successful is the Honeys, although I did do tracks with several of those other, 911, for example. You know, it was a kind of a pop world. That period, I have to say, was where I gained the most credibility with my daughters, because they were the perfect age for those sorts of groups. And I remember them coming home from school one day, and I was working with 911, because at that time I had a studio in my house. And they were like really excited to come home from school and meet 911. You know,
that is epic.
Which is kind of, I was called dad for a minute.
That is really epic. And how hands-on was music producing when you very, very first started, or, you know, back in the 80s? What was the actual job role? What were you doing on a day-to-day
basis? Well, it changed. I started as a sound engineer. Mm-hmm. And what was really apparent in the beginning when I first started was that in the UK, the role of the sound engineer was really just the person that pushed the faders up and got the sound. And there wasn't really much kind of creativity, as in the producer was the person that ran the show. When I went to America very early on, because I was working on an album with the group Sailor, who had Glass of Champagne and Girls, 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 they're kind of big hits. But Bruce Johnson from the Beach Boys was producing their third record. And this was done in London. And then he said to me, Steve, you need to come to California. So actually, in the late 70s, I went to California for the first time. And the role of the sound engineer there is completely different, or was very different. They were considered to be the kind of right-hand person to the music producer. And when I was starting, the role of the producer was very different. You had producers who are like impresarios. They discover the talent, but they would bring in an arranger. They bring in session players. There were also producers who were arrangers. I mean, people are probably aware of Quincy Jones and Arif Mardin. Those producers were also arrangers in their own right. And then as we moved towards the 80s, the role of the producer changed dramatically, where a knowledge of the technical way of making records, because we started entering the world of digital recording, lots and lots of synthesizers. So for producers like myself, who had grown up in the sort of early days of synths, we had kind of the knowledge, you know, so we knew how to sort of transition to this digital era. And so when you look at the CVs of the successful producers in the 80s, you know, myself, Trevor Horn, it's having that background that really helped to make the records.
And how much, you know, you say that you can start when you develop, start getting a more creative role. How much influence do you have over the sound of a song versus the artist? So, because I don't know too much about the music industry, and my understanding of producers comes from Pitch Perfect and another film that I saw recently called I Used to Be Famous, where they always get off on a bad foot with the artist, because artist like sends in their song, and then the producer comes along and goes, "You want it to sound like this." Are you that guy?
Well, I think the two roles in the music industry of the thankless tasks are being a record producer and being a band's manager. Because when everything goes well, everybody else takes credit for the success. And when it goes wrong, it's the producer's fault. I won't say the person's name, but a couple of years ago, when actually we were going to Ibiza for holiday, we were in the airport and there was quite a delay. And we were waiting at the luggage carousel, and there was quite a famous artist. I won't say his name, but he was on the phone to his manager, and they were obviously really unhappy with some of the mixes or something, but he was completely blaming the producer on the phone. And I thought, come on now, you know, you were obviously there. So the role of the producer has changed, and it is fair to say that the producer does have an influence, but it does depend on the type of band. You know, if you go back to the 60s and you think of producers like Phil Spector, that was the wall of sound. The sound that Phil made was the sound of those records. I have a slightly different role, although I admire those producers from that period enormously. If I'm working with a band, so for example, I'm working with an indie band in Liverpool called the Hushtones, and that's we've got an album coming out later in the year, and we've just got a single out at the moment. Your role with a band is to sort of understand what they have as an idea for their song, understand the kind of sonic landscape of that song, and try and open the option. So have you tried this particular guitar sound or this guitar pedal, or what if the drums sounded like this? So that's where it works well. And in the case of the Hushtones, I've worked with them for so many years. We have a sort of code, you know, we kind of know what's what. With somebody like May, what's really lovely is we develop the song from zero. You know, we'll have a blank page. You might say, I've got an idea. I mean, for example, Gatekeeper, which I just mentioned, that came about because another song of ours was played on the radio and it had one word that the BBC thought was a profanity, but it wasn't. And they cut it out, but they didn't previously tell us that they were going to do that. And so when the record played, we were both heartbroken as that somebody had done an edit on our song. And that's when we were on the phone to each other and we said, oh, it's terrible. These gatekeepers looking after. And we thought, you know what? That's the seed of an idea. But then the story of Gatekeeper is about her previous examples of being a woman in the music industry, which is really tough. And so although it's a kind of chill out, Ibiza groovy song, the lyric is a poignant lyric for young women of a certain age who have a lot of issues to deal with being in the music business. You know, some of it has changed for the better, but it's still not as good as it should be. And in our current record, So Glad, but that came about because I was working with MT Jones on his own record, which came out before and was incidentally was very, very well received in Europe. I mean, I had some incredible reviews from Europe, and we wanted to kind of work on a song together. And the idea came fairly quickly. And again, she's speaking from a woman's perspective in the lyric. And so with her, the song develops the sound, but with a band, you know, it's a kind of a conversation.
And from your point of view, I guess, as more of an observer, what sort of issues are young women facing in the music industry?
Unfortunately, there's a lot of, you know, I guess the casting couch is a euphemism that we can use that covers a lot. And also, particularly, I think, with young women producers, taking them seriously. You know, I think it, you know, as a father of daughters, I understand a lot of these pressures. And I think it's, you know, it is a lot better. It is better than it was when I was growing up. You know, when I first started as an engineer, it was very, very sexist and misogynistic, but it has changed a bit. It's still not totally better, but I think women can feel more comfortable in a recording studio than perhaps ever before, but it can still improve.
And has technology played a role in that improvement? Are women, you know, able to start out more in their bedrooms, getting more hands-on, a bit more independence rather
Very
than having
much
to
so.
Rely on someone else to propel them forward? And use that as well to springboard into a bigger conversation about technology and how it's
changing
landscape.
Well, I agree with that entirely. I think some of the changes in technology have benefited all sorts of different sort of roles. So in the simplest form, if you have an idea for a song, most phones and laptops have some form of recording in them that allow you to get that song idea down, whether you can play an instrument or not. And if you can play an instrument, it's a world of opportunities. If you're not so proficient, there are software devices. There's a lot of loop libraries around. So you can construct something that does give you a really good starting point on a song. And I think to answer your question, I think it does allow anybody, but particularly women that might need to work with someone else, it gives them a sort of blueprint. They can say to a producer or an engineer, this is the blueprint of kind of where I want to take the song. How do we now kind of put it on steroids and make it sound like a record? Because obviously there's a big difference between a home demo. In fact, I like to use the phrase, there's home recording and recording at home, and they're not the same. If you can record at home professionally, you can get incredible results. But a home recording often does sound like a demo. But having said that, there are one or two of the acts I've worked with who have seed ideas. So I'll give two examples. On the Hushtones, they did a demo at home of a particular song, and Martha, the lead singer in that particular band, had a vocal idea that she'd been experimenting with, where she had sung into her laptop but had manipulated the vocal with some reverbs to create quite an unusual sounding, almost like an instrument. And rather than trying to recreate that, we just took that out of her laptop into our master recording, and that was really good. And then there's an artist I'm working with at the moment, Jess Eady. In fact, her record came out yesterday, and there's a couple of vocals in the middle of that where we took those off the demo because we really loved the sound that, you know, often sometimes when you're putting an idea down very quickly, you sort of just get the idea down, and sometimes an accident will happen, and that's really good. And then on So Glad, the current Maybe record, the vocals at the very beginning, and maybe if you play it, the audience can listen again. So the ooze at the beginning, we have a microphone set up in the control room, very similar to what you've got, but it's in the control room, it's not in the studio. And while we were running through the demo idea of the song, they both went, oh, got this idea, you know, doo-doo, and went, oh, that's really good, let's quickly record that, and we'll come back to it. We were going through the song, and every time we listened to it, we went, you know what, that sounds really good. And so we left it, even though it's a, you know, in the Steve Levine world, a slightly substandard fidelity recording, but it has a vibe on it. And so we kept the vibe. So I'm always keen with people working at home to listen to what they have recorded, just in case they've captured something because they were in the right mood or the right moment, or sometimes an accident occurred with the recording process that made it sound really special.
And how confident are you when a song sounds special that it's going to be a hit? Because you have worked on songs that were a hit. Were you like, did you know? Were you like, this is going to be the one?
No, if every producer knew that, every single record would be a hit. I mean, take Culture Club, for example. The first record that we made, White Boy Dance, I thought was tremendous. It literally failed to light the world. I'm Afraid of Me, the second Culture Club single, failed miserably. But the third single, Do You Really Want to Hurt Me, had something special. And it only occurred to me it had something special probably around the time of not mixing, because we mixed it and we thought, this is really good. But it was the first time that I actually heard it played on the radio. And in those days, we had early support, believe it or not, from BBC Radio 2. The first time I heard it on the radio, I thought, oh, hang on a minute. This actually, compared to all the other records that were being played at the time, this has a unique sound. It's to this day, actually still sounds timeless. It's one of those weird sort of things. It doesn't actually, although it's from the 80s, it doesn't actually sound from the 80s. And so that, when I first heard that on the radio, I thought, that's really interesting. And the second time was the very first Top of the Pops they did, which they were very lucky to get. I presume your audience, being expats, knows all of these television references.
I suspect so.
The story goes they got Top of the Pops because Elton John had Blue Eyes out at the time and only had a video. And for some reason, BBC didn't want to play the video. They wanted live acts in the studio. And Culture Club were the highest new entry, but only at 30-something. You know, it wasn't even and they got Top of the Pops. And the moment they were on Top of the Pops, as soon as Top of the Pops finished, my phone rang and I thought, this is going to be a big hit. This is really, and obviously it was. That's the first time I've ever had that, because that was my first ever big hit. When we were mixing Karma Chameleon, we had the same feeling. And I remember the record company coming down to the studio to listen to that. And we thought, oh, that's interesting. And so throughout my career, it's different things. With the Honeys, for example, a very strange thing happened. They were out on tour in Australia, and the record actually wasn't out. But Selena, the lead singer in the Honeys, had a test pressing, because that either a test pressing or I think it was a test pressing, and played it to the host on the radio station, and they played it on air, which, you know, technically speaking, they weren't really allowed to do because it was a few weeks away from being released. And in those days, there was quite a real moratorium on things being released, being aired before they were physically released. And in those days, it was physically released because it was all on CD. And it went mad. I mean, in the space of 24 hours, everyone was going mad for that. That was the song Finally Found. And I thought, oh, my God, this is going to be a hit. This really has got something special. And that certainly was a big worldwide hit. So you get a sense of it. But it's very hard to know at the time, because when you work on something, you get so used to it, you often love it so much that, you know.
Yeah, but still, what an epic feeling to have experienced, you know, a few times through your career. So I think it's very privileged to have been able to experience that. It's nice.
It is, but you still, honestly, every time you hear, like Jess, who I'm working with at the moment, you know, we got a play last night on the radio, very first time. It's only been out less than 24 hours, and it's a thrill. It is still a thrill.
Oh, yeah, fantastic. I just wanted to ask one more question about technology and the evolution of the music culture before we go on to playing the track. And it's more about how music is consumed so digitally these days and how that's affected things for artists, their ability to get noticed, to become successful, and then also actually make money.
So let's start with the sonic world. So there are now some additional, for me as a record producer, some additional thrills that you can make, because the majority of the audience are going to be listening on headphones. Now, depending on their service, whether it's Spotify, Apple Music, or Amazon, or one of the others, the quality of the reproduction of streaming services varies quite considerably, from probably Apple being high quality to Spotify being quite average. You know, if someone does play the same song on Apple and Spotify, there is a sonic difference between the two. Apple is superior. But having said that, one, knowing that people are going to be listening on headphones, one is able to, as a producer, do things that perhaps you wouldn't have done before with the panning. And what I'm very pleased to say, both Maeve's, this current single, So Glad, and Maeve's previous single, Futuristic, that's actually been one of the great comments that people have said is, oh my God, I can hear these things, this like ear candy going around my head. So as a producer, it offers a sonic playground that actually you can do things that perhaps you wouldn't do before, because two things. Number one, if people are listening on speakers, they may not necessarily hear it properly. So many people at home have, you know, hi-fi systems where the speakers are all over the place. You know, it's not a dedicated control room. Whereas headphones, the quality of headphones has improved exponentially over the last few years. So even an average price pair of headphones sound really good. So that's, for me as a producer, that's fabulous. So I hope that people can enjoy that. And as bandwidth gets better and better, the fidelity, because all of the services expect you to deliver the masters at high level, high quality. It's just that some of them are not playing that back. But as bandwidth increases, the quality will improve, of course. So that's the sonic part. The money-making is really difficult. Spotify, for example, don't even pay anything below 1,000 plays. And something like 70 or 80% of what's on Spotify doesn't ever achieve that. That's outrageous. I think it's because of the way the public are understanding things. When people pay their monthly subscription, it doesn't go to their fans directly. So, you know, people probably do understand the model of streaming is there's a monthly subscription that goes into a pot and then the pot is divided up. But those at the top of the food chain get the most of the pot, and those at the bottom of the food chain get zero. So trying to make a living in the music industry currently is horrendous from streaming, absolutely horrendous, because only a few are earning a fortune. It's like a massive gap. Bands and artists that are able to make physical copies and sell those at gigs can still make some money with both physical CDs or vinyl or whatever they want to sell, or even cassettes now making a comeback, or t-shirts. So their merchandising is valuable. And if they're a medium band, maybe they've got some ability to get a reasonable fee when playing live. But at the lower end, the fees are also. So you're absolutely right. It is horrendous out there at the moment for the sort of low to medium end for any artist to make any money. It's really difficult. The only way that artists can make money currently is if they're lucky enough to get a synchronization in a film or a television program, because that does pay obviously a fee for the license to use it, and they get royalties on the broadcast. And then of course, staring down the barrel of a gun is AI, which, you know, unless the United Kingdom's government steps up to the plate, the industry is literally could be destroyed overnight, because the current training of the AI modeling is like a wild west. What the music industry is proposing is that, like it is at the moment, if you want to use a piece of music in a film, you go to the songwriter and the publisher and you go to the artist and you agree a price and you have a license. Very simple. And it's been that way since the beginning of times, or since the beginning of the industry. They're trying to say that artists should, it should all be available free of charge and the artist should opt out. That's impossible. You know, particularly for younger artists, it's impossible. So we are at a very difficult crossroads at the moment, certainly in terms of, and I believe Europe is the same. I don't think the United Kingdom is separate to that. I think we are all one voice. It's just obviously since we've left the EU, we're not having those conversations as one. But I believe the European government is of the same, and the music industry, particularly the strong voices of France and Germany, where they're very strong on copyright. But we have to, AI, if they want to use the masters that are out there to learn, and no one's saying don't do that. They're just saying we want to be compensated. Absolutely. It's the most important thing, because if that slips, then there is nothing.
Yeah, well, watch this space. And without further ado, Steve, I'm going to hand it over to you to introduce this next song.
So this is our latest Baltic Jazz Recordings release, and it's So Glad, which is Mavy, and it features MT Jones.
Yesterday, and watch our sweet moment.